Some of your people just about missed it.
Listening to beautiful music from Angeli Kidjo, whose new album is Remain in Light, and it's a reimagining of a Talking Heads album, 1980 album of the same name, Remain in Light. And it's going to be, she is going to be at UPAC in Kingston on the 11th. So that's next Friday, next Thursday, and you can find out more at bardabon.org, and Sarah LaDuca is going to talk to Angeli Kidjo later on in the program, so there you go.
We'll, you pack peanut butter.
You pack peanut butter. have you ever been to that venue?
Yes.
That's a beautiful, beautiful thing. I just went there recently for the first time in Kingston, and it's a gorgeous, gorgeous place.
I didn't
place.
Mean to denigrate it in any way.
No, it's just a beautiful place.
I never do that.
Terry is nodding. I assume you've been. Is that your? That's sort of your neck of the woods.
What are we talking about?
UPAC.
Okay, you're still with the music. I get it. Okay, understood. Let me introduce our panel. We have a great one, and we'll get started. We have a lot to talk about. Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith is with us. Good morning, Jen.
Heyo, good morning.
She's already, we've had her operating cameras and doing all kinds of stuff this morning, so... put her to work. Former New York State Senator, SUNY New Paltz Communications Professor Terry Gibson is in the house. Good morning, sir.
Thank you. I'm sorry. You brought up the Talking Heads, and so I was sort of like...
Yeah, I know.
He went to
a
place.
And, I'm happy to be here as a Talking Head this morning. Thank you very much.
Nicely done. And Times Union columnist extraordinaire Chris Churchill. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you here.
Yo, curmudgeon.
Huh?
You old curmudgeon.
I'm not a curmudgeon.
Yeah, you're a curmudgeon.
I'm not old enough to be a curmudgeon. Don't you?
Aspiring curmudgeon?
Yeah, aspiring, yeah. Wannabe curmudgeon.
You're getting there. That's great.
Oh, good.
Good
great.
For you. Chris Churchill is here, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. So we were just checking our internet. And
wait, I'm here too.
Oh, Alan Churchill. I'm so sorry, Alan. I thought I started with you. I'm sorry.
It's just assumed.
It's been a while.
I'll just go sit in the corner.
It's a nice full table this morning.
You know what happens? I start here because I always want to end with you, and I start there, and then I go down, and then I think I'm done.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it's just, it's not.
No, it's okay.
I know. All right. We have internet.
Hey.
For those of you here in the studio who were trying to get it, we have it. Thank you to Stacy for making that happen. Okay, let's go to, we talked about this yesterday, but now we know a little bit more than we did before, which is regarding health care. You will recall that the governor on Sunday night started to tweet out and say, all those things that he had said about healthcare and we're going to make the best healthcare and we're going to be the party of the healthcare. We're not going to do that until after 2020 election. So not till 2021. So just kidding. Now we realize, which I think Alan was said this yesterday, but that the tap on the shoulder came from Mitch McConnell, who privately warned the president that the Senate would not revisit health care in a comprehensive way before the 2020 elections. Reversing himself in the face of Republican consternation, Mr. Trump said his party would not produce a health care plan of its own, as he had promised, until after the elections, meaning he will only try to fulfill his first term promise to repeal and replace his predecessor's signature program if he wins a second term. So you sort of dangle that out there and say, all right, if you want this, even though I didn't do it the first time, give me 4 more years and maybe I can get it done then.
And let's remember there's a federal judge out there who's already said the entire program has to be thrown out the window because it doesn't work, because it's not legal. So obviously he's going to be overruled on this somewhere up the line, we can only hope. But what can I tell you?
Yeah, I mean, it's very soap opery because I feel like we were talking about this last week and we were making these predictions and gosh darn, here we are on
we
as the policy
right.
flips.
We were 100% right, isn't that cool?
And again,
how many
you
times
know,
can you say that?
I think it just, what happens next, obviously, like people need health care. People need something, but it's just another example of these baseless claims and no policy or plan to back up, intentions.
Well, I also think that this is sort of just a rerun of a strategy that clearly has not worked for the Republicans. I mean, just ask Paul Ryan and any other Republican if health care is a good thing to run on. They tried to overturn Obamacare. It didn't work. It's what allowed the Democrats to take over the House. So I'm not exactly sure, looking ahead to the next election, assuming he even wins, that this is even a good strategy.
But Terry,
that's a terrible strategy, I think.
I'm sorry, Chris. Did you want to?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the Republicans have screwed themselves. Mitch McConnell tapped the president on the shoulder and said, we're not going to do this.
But
in my opinion, as brief as it may be, in my opinion, by just saying we're going to leave it till 2021, they've done the same thing. In other words, as I said this morning, a guy walks up to you and says, would you rather I hit you over the head now, or would you rather I hit you over the head in 2020?
And how audacious, though, to put so much ego into, like, healthcare and, like, something that's not just a personal campaign, promise, but it's something that really does matter to people. And to say, like, oh, we'll take care of it in a year, like,
yeah, it makes people very anxious to think
It absolutely does. And that was a point we were talking about last week, is that people get anxious when you propose any change to their health care, and to keep them waiting in limbo. And it also boggles my mind too that this party, the Republican Party, continues to back someone who they're at odds with. They don't agree. What Mitch McConnell said and did is no surprise to anyone, because he's held that stance for as long as we've heard him talk about it. Again, the president will say one thing and speak for the party, and even though he's not a Republican, and then they continue to still support him.
There's a line in this article. Mitch McConnell said, I pointed out to him the Senate Republicans' view on dealing with comprehensive health care reform with a Democratic House of Representatives. But if that warning was meant to quiet the president, it did not work. According to the New York Times.
Exactly.
Hours later, Mr. Trump wrote on Twitter, the Republicans are developing a really great health care plan with far lower premiums, cost, and deductibles than Obamacare. In other words, it will be far less expensive and much more usable than Obamacare, he said in a string of three tweets posted Monday night. Vote will be taken right after the election when Republicans hold the Senate and win back the House. Well, there's a lot of
that same article says that Trump is worried that if the Republicans go into 2020 as the party, or will go into 2020 as the party that couldn't come up with a health care plan, mm-hmm. which is actually accurate. Mm-hmm. That is how they're going to go into 2020, and that is a weakness. It doesn't mean that you can just pretend that you have a plan, though. I mean, you actually have to come up with them. But I don't know if you guys have seen, but there's reportedly Mitt Romney is working on mm-hmm. a new plan,
and
which would replace Obamacare, which is kind of ironic, given that
he created
yes.
the Romney Obamacare is based on Romney care,
yes. right?
Yeah.
But, I was just going to say that at least two of us in this room, Jen and I, live in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. where this all started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and can Romney do that? And at the end of the day, though, will he get the support from the party that is?
Well, and
is
will
leading?
Romney's plan be Trump's plan? Because yeah. those guys obviously don't always see eye to eye.
But Trump doesn't have a plan. That's his problem.
Well, I know.
He doesn't
know.
Have a plan. Yeah. He has no idea what he's talking about.
But is that what he's referring to? I agree with you, Alan. But is that what he's referring to when he says the Republicans are working on a plan?
I have no idea.
Romney plan?
I don't think so. I think it's interesting. He says, like, the Republicans, like, somehow forgetting the fact that he is the Republican. Mm-hmm. But the thing I think is really going on is that he's just like with everything with Trump, he's not really interested in solving a problem, and he has no clue how to solve a problem. He's looking for that language that will excite his base, and so he's trying to once again leverage this attack on Obamacare and trying to see if his base will rise up and go, yeah, we still need to get rid of Obamacare. And what he's finding out is that it's really lost its resonance. It's not really resonating the way it used to. And so
I disagree that resonates with his base. I think he risks alienating sections of his base with that kind of talk. Mm-hmm. I mean, he ran in 2016 as the guy who was going to protect a lot of the healthcare things that people already enjoy. He wasn't going to cut Medicare, Medicaid. He wasn't going to, he didn't run as this kind of fiscal conservative Paul Ryan type. He ran as kind of a more economically liberal person. And then And so to me, that was successful, and this kind of cuts against that message.
But he did want to overturn Obamacare. I mean, the whole part of his first months in office was about trying to repeal and replace Obamacare. He wanted to do that.
Yeah, but to me, I remember that language being muted during the actual election. He may have switched as soon as, you know, he got into office.
Well, but he really wanted not only to overturn Obamacare, he wanted to overturn Obama. I mean, right. that obsession with him is something that I, even with him, that I don't fully understand what that's all about.
Well, I think it's just ego and jealousy. But you can't neglect the fact, too, that...
I would add racism.
Yeah, many other things. But if you are talking about people who are in those base areas, they are facing some of the country's most tremendous and harsh and chronic health problems too. And again, if he does anything to really take away things that are taking care of Blackland for mine workers or
opioid crisis
in you know, Appalachia and so many places like that, there's going to be bigger problems.
I mean, Trump's thing, rightly or wrongly, has been that he's speaking for the working class, right? Mm-hmm. This cuts against that, and this to me just adds to the anxiety that a lot of working class people will feel.
Health is hugely a working class issue.
What's ultimately missing here, though, is that Trump just continually lacks the leadership skills to really go to his advisors, go to the experts in the field that he wants to focus on, and begin to lead the way in finding a solution. He doesn't have the ability to do that. And so we just keep hearing him waking up every morning saying, hey, we should work on this today. What do you think? And that's all hashed out in public, which is the most ineffective way to go about solving any problem.
I was talking with a colleague yesterday about how it feels like we devote so much time and energy to talking about these things that Trump just throws out there that are never really going to happen or just kind of, whims. They're just whims. We spend a lot of time talking about them, then they never really happen.
Well, that's, case in point is the border, right?
Right. That's the theme of his presidency in a lot of ways. But it's almost like, well, maybe we should just ignore what he says. You know, obviously you can't do that when you're talking about the president of the United States. But he does just have this way of just sucking up all the energy and just dominating the conversation. But a lot of it is just empty.
It's just empty hyperbole with no real action behind it. Nothing ever is really being resolved. And therefore, we are kind of all living in a state of chaos. Just look at the border right now. With all of his talk about the border, the situation is just, you know, reaching a state in which everyone's in panic because there's no leadership. There's no one saying, this is how we're going to solve the problem.
Interesting. It's interesting that Republicans in Congress are as frustrated as anybody because, you know, he's continually stepping on what could be good messages and good themes. Mm-hmm.
But they tap him, as Alan said, you know, they tap him on the shoulder, but they don't do more than that, which seems like...
Well, I think that's a failure of leadership. Like, you know, leadership is not meant to be by one person. You're meant to advise and lead people and use facts and trust. And I think that's what fails this administration is the refusal to trust in the other people who are experts in things to make good decisions. And also for people who are those experts to stand for what they stand for. Everyone is afraid to speak up and speak truth and, you know, say like, this is really what's at stake.
Let me just say, I think that, we should all remember one thing. Somehow this guy got himself to be president of the United States. So, you know, it may be chicanery, it may be potential fascism, it may be any of that. But to say that he's not a leader, he's a leader all right. He's a leader in the wrong sense.
I think Republicans are more than tapping him on the shoulder. It kind of reminds me of more like a parent-toddler relationship where the you know, the toddler is saying, I want ice cream. And the parent is saying, well, sorry, you're not having ice cream. You know, like McConnell pretty much said, no, this healthcare thing you're talking about is not.
I'm going to turn this car right around.
But Chris, only for one reason. And that is, up until now, they have been obsequious to a point of vomitatiousness. You know, whatever he wanted, the guys would turn around. And McConnell was the worst of them. But this is, there's a line in Shogun. Anybody ever read
that? Oh, yeah. James Clavell.
James Clavell, in which the Shogun says to his son, you're inconvenient now. Please kill yourself. But you kill yourself. Well, that's the whole point here.
Yeah.
He is now expecting them to kill themselves and to lose their majority, and they just won't do it.
No.
It's the dividing line.
Well, right. I think the Republicans are, you know, so much to blame for the state of their president, because even if they had a good idea, and I think that, you know, somewhere in that group there must be some good ideas, even if they did have a good idea, let's just say that Mitt Romney maybe has an idea about how to deal with health care, it'll never see the light of day because this president will make sure that he stomps on it like he stomps on every good idea and messes it up with his crazy messaging. So, and they continue to promote him and give him this microphone without any, you know, restrictions on it. And so they're creating this disaster.
I would take you guys back, all of you, including you, Jen, and when I say guys, it's meant that way. I would take you back to the primary elections in which everything we think about Trump was being said by his adversaries, you know, about why he shouldn't be president. So it isn't as if they don't know. They know. One of the things that's so terrible about them is the hypocrisy and the lack of guts that they all show right now.
Well, I really think that's it. I think it's not that there isn't you know, dissent within the Republican Party, but it's not happening at the rate we see in the Democratic Party, where there is much more of an outspoken spectrum of politics.
You know, the Democrats have their own set of issues that we're all trying to work out. So, you know, it's not as if we have nothing to worry about either, but it's very different in that we're trying to figure out who we want to be president. And the Republicans have decided that they're very happy with this person being president, and they're trying to figure out a way to keep him president and actually do something at the same time. And that's not working out very well.
We are just about out of time for this break. We remind you that you can certainly write us a letter. Panel@WAMC.org will continue after this short break. He dreams of days that he can still remember. Now. Again, listening to the music of Angelique Kidjo, and she's going to be performing at UPAC in Kingston on next Thursday, which is April 11th, and you can find out more by going to bardavon.org, and we'll be talking to her later on in our program. We have a lot of letters. We're going to get to those. You can write us letters to panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and Alan has a few.
I have a few of the lot that you just referred to. And Vince says, hello, panel. I honestly believe that Donald Trump is repealing the Affordable Care Act for no other reason than he was completely offended by Barack Obama's jokes about him at the 2011 White House Correspondents' Dinner. Trump was completely livid, and as a narcissist, he must win at any cost. More of a personal vendetta than a policy change, Vince.
Now, you had mentioned this earlier about the schoolyard, but my understanding of that wasn't when the president was responding to the birther, the start of the birther controversy.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say necessarily. I know it doesn't matter who started it, Donald Trump, the businessman, was the one who was stirring that up prior to the president lashing out, as you could understand why he would.
Well,
the
president embarrassed him, rightly so. We were all, at least I was very happy to see him do that. And so maybe he's never recovered from that.
You would think becoming president would kind of be enough of an ego stroke that you could get over those things, right?
I mean, it's for normal
long,
people, yes.
Ugly grudge.
Yeah.
I
mean, it all has to do with personality and character. Yeah, you know, Freud was right about all of that. Yeah, he said it for, you go back in this guy's history, that's what it was happening. He's a bully. Come on now, everybody. He's a bully. That's what motivates him to do his thing.
There's just, you keep reading these stories, though, and they're just, to me, endlessly fascinating, and I wish Freud were here to tell us more.
I wish you were here, too.
But one of the things that I find fascinating is the story about him the president continually saying that his father's German, was born in Germany,
right.
and he was born in New York City,
yes.
And right. yet he continues right. to say he's born in Germany, and well, it's easy to find out, and it's been proven, and even he admits that it was the case, but yet he keeps on saying it, and I don't know.
No one's thrown the kid at him, though, the DNA kid.
No, well, there you go. Yeah, 23andMe, there you go.
He lies with impunity. Okay, then we did this one. Trump was a little bit narcissistic. Yeah, we did that. Thank you very much. And then we heard from Russ, who says, squeeze play. Dear panel, we forget that the Republicans have been able to turn back the leading edge of Obamacare by eliminating the individual mandate and defunding reinsurance corridors for new health insurance providers. The Democrats' next step might simply be to bring back the Affordable Care Act. Single payer is electorally doomed. And that's Russ from Manassas. Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, I think eventually we're going to get there. Eventually, because there are a lot of things that we have to worry about here. For example, raise your hand if you really are worried about the insurance companies going broke. You know, right. I mean, that's what this is about. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some people who put their hand in and come out with a bunch of money. But we have to examine the central premise as to whether that's a good idea.
Well, and
hey, Social Security works, doesn't it?
So far.
Yeah.
I'm hoping it hangs on for a while.
But that's the thing. I mean, if you really want to evolve and make a proper 21st century plan, you really have to take into all the health issues that are in account. And you can't just make tweaks. You have to make really dedicated reform.
So go a little further, because I'm not sure I'm on the same page.
Well, I think, you're preserving and protecting little bits, you know, where, like, you want to expand Medicare or you want to, you know, do that. But I think there are still bigger problems, like the cost of medications and how much, you know, insurance will or will not pay. If you ask, you know, people who are on most employers' health plans, they have like $5,000 deductibles. So you're paying for plans, and I don't think that's fair, equitable either. I mean, what do you know?
Well,
that's not being addressed in these conversations, and that's why, you know, when people are saying like, oh, we're going to make the best plan, well, you have to talk about these issues.
You also have to remember that Obamacare was a compromise. You know, it started out with a much grander vision of being something very close to single payer. And at the end, you know, they had to make compromises. Mm-hmm. So it's not – they knew when they passed it. It wasn't the perfect answer to everything. So we did get that far. And I tend to agree with Alan that I think that with a new president and with new leadership that really does want to make healthcare a priority and making sure that everyone gets access to it in an affordable way, I think that we will take it another step. Mm-hmm. But it is very complicated and it will take time.
Well, and it also ties into just campaign and other – you know, political finance and you know, what companies are paying who at the end of the day. And because that's not separated, that's why we end up with compromises.
Kevin writes, Mitch McConnell should be getting the hour-long investigative reporting on CNN and PBS and NPR that his anti-democratic behavior deserves. That's from Kevin.
All right.
I can't disagree with that. All right. And then down to the last letter I have for now.
All right.
Tony writes, Trump and immigration. Hi, panel. Does anyone know what Trump's big problem is with the Mexican border? He seems as crazily obsessed with this issue as he is with Obama. Is it just that these immigrants are not white? Thanks from Tony. Well, you know, here comes another load of...
I mean, it certainly seems that... we can't remember... point has been made a billion times, mm-hmm. but... It is the first thing he said when he announced his candidacy mm-hmm. of talking about the Mexicans.
But he seems
that there are big problems at the border and that there are things that need to be fixed. I mean, there is a.
But would you agree with
a surge of migrants coming, and there are all sorts of things. It's just that the solutions he's offering don't really make any sense.
Do you think it's an emergency?
I don't think it's I don't think it's an emergency. Although, you know, I said recently in a column it wasn't an emergency, and I got about 300 emails saying, why did you say that? So if I reverse myself, I'm going to get a whole bunch. It might be becoming an emergency. I mean, the surge.
But maybe an emergency of his own making?
I was going to.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean,
I think you're right.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I think the rhetoric, though, there's a problem with that. I think going back to the letter writer, the obsession with Mexico being the problem when clearly all the current wave of people that are coming in are not from Mexico.
Right.
And that's the bigger issue. I think he's being negligent at really understanding why people are leaving other places in the first place. And even though we...
Well, and cutting aid to those places will just exacerbate the problems
Absolutely.
That are forcing people to leave and come mm-hmm. north, right? Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. There, he's not wrong that there's a problem. He's just not offering solutions to the problem. That
he's looking at it the wrong way.
Yeah. Well, stop taking it seriously. This is really... It's serious, all right. But it's really about his inflaming his base, finding an issue that he thinks people can understand on the most simplistic level yeah. at all.
I'll say, though, I think Democrats are making a mistake if they don't treat this as a serious issue. Mm-hmm. I do think
it is a serious issue.
You're right. And I do think that people in states like Texas and Arizona realize that maybe not.
But with all due respect, then why aren't the governors of Texas and Mexico standing up with the president when he does these events and saying,
because they don't agree with the solutions. They may or may not agree that there's a big problem. I think that they probably do. But the solutions don't make sense.
And
things like closing the border would be devastating for Texas.
And they also know that there is an increasing Hispanic population votes in their districts. Mm-hmm. They're not about to eliminate all of that.
Well, and commerce. If you listen to any of them talking, you know, in border, you know, border towns, there's a lot of, you know, commerce that happens back and forth between. You have to keep those borders open.
You know, it's ironic. Trump is very, very upset with Mexico for not stopping the flow of migrants to the southern border. Meanwhile, Canada is upset with us because mm-hmm. there are so many migrants, asylum-seeking migrants landing, you know, at their border. Mm. It's not that easy when people come in on visas and do and find ways and then go to Canada. This is very difficult to stop.
And yet when Trump had to find a reason to buckle under to the Republicans who were showing signs of rebellion over the border crossing as well as other things, where did he go? He went back and reversed himself like Roadrunner and said, well, you know, I don't have to do this after all because the Mexicans are really complying and helping us keep them out. He says whatever comes to his mind whenever he needs something.
He's twisting himself into like a pretzel shape, going back and forth and sideways. You know, the immigration issue, if we take a step back, there's plenty of blame to go around. We are in this situation because neither Democrats nor Republicans, nor even really any president in the past, has really been able to step up and take the lead on immigration and come up with some type of solution that would be a sensible approach to how to deal with our borders. That hasn't happened. And so now we are in a state of panic and chaos. And I do think some of the things happening to the border are reaching a crisis level. I mean, you hear the human stories about people suffering, and it's really sad. It's tragic. And this president actually does have an opportunity to step up and try to be a leader on this issue and offer some type of sensible solution, but he's not able to do that. He can't offer sensible solutions. He can't offer any type of effective leadership. He just keeps looking for someone to vilify and blame and keeps forgetting that he's actually president now.
So both parties have failed on illegal immigration for a long time. You know, you could say that the Republicans failed because they... The Chamber of Commerce was happy to have this flow of people coming in. You know, you could say the Democrats failed because they benefited politically too. But I think it's important to differentiate what's happening now from illegal immigration. I mean, people aren't coming in illegally. They're coming across intentionally, getting arrested, and then applying for asylum. That's a very different thing.
So the question
and
it is,
clogs the court system, and it forces you to have places to put all these people. I mean, right. We may have a million asylum seekers this year alone.
So is Trump then, therefore, responsible for this increase now? In other words, people are watching him, people are watching what he said, people are watching what he's doing. For some reason, it seems...
It's hard to know
because I don't know what information filters down to the average person in Honduras or...
Well, something is...
I don't know what media...
Well, it's
probably more likely the economic and the violent situation.
Why the surges? Because it's getting worse.
It's absolutely getting worse. And you have to understand that whole pathway, if you look from a geographical standpoint, there's so much tension and pressure and human rights issues. There's so much corruption. There's so much lack of basic needs in countries. And so when you have a push of people leaving, like, say, from Venezuela with all that's happening now and pushing north or something like that,
you see a lot of Venezuelans at our border?
You don't see as many, but you know that is going to change, too, because Venezuela itself had a big influx back in 2010 after the Haiti earthquake. You had a lot of Haitians who went there. And yeah. I think the missed opportunity is migration is a huge issue globally. And the U.S. could be a leader in solving some of these things and coming up with, better solutions, but no one's talking about
that. We're late for break.
We are.
So let's do that, and we'll come back. We'll continue our conversation. We have other things to talk about. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, and it's good to have you all here. Everybody's fired up. We're talking during the break, getting things worked out, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan has a couple, and then we'll move on to other topics.
I do. Here we go. Dear panel, good morning. I hear all the complaints, in quotes, about Trump and his bizarre behavior, and yet he is the president, still the president, and is still leading in the polls. That's not true. He is not leading in the polls.
Rasmussen poll.
Yeah, the best that Republicans can have. So why do we keep talking about his bizarre behavior? Let's focus our energy on how we can remove him or beat him in the election. The Democrats are already messing it up. Thanks, Bernie from Woodburn.
How are the Democrats messing
Bernie from Burlington.
Yes. how are the Democrats? I'm interested in that because I've heard that complaint, and I'm just curious of what else. I mean, we're in the very early stages of a campaign. All of the candidates, some perhaps haven't even announced yet. Subtle way of saying we don't know what Joe Biden's up to. And so everyone's finding their place. They're finding their footing. I don't know. How are they screwing it up?
Well, obviously, if you get a primary, people are going to start yelling at each other, and you can suspect that when you hear something bad about one of them, somebody has put the Mickey in, as we have said so often. That may be part of it.
But you can't avoid that, right?
I don't think so. I think it's all part of the democratic process. I think you can't silence people. You have to let people step out and listen to what they have to say, and people have a right to criticize their opponents if they think that they're going in the wrong direction. So I think it's all part of the natural evolution. I think it's actually good for the Democratic Party. I think as a loyal Democrat myself, I like what's happening. I like that there are so many candidates out there voicing so many different perspectives. And I think it's really what the Democratic Party is all about. And I think we'll be the better for this process. And it's so early. It is so early that I think we have plenty of time to work these things out.
I was reacting to the letter writer's contention that they were already screwing it up. And I don't think so.
I don't believe that. I don't think we're screwing it up at all. I think by not doing what we're doing right now, we would be screwing it up. By anointing someone right now and expecting that person to maintain popularity all the way through the election, I think would be a huge mistake. I think we need to vet the candidates out.
I mean, I'm not sure what he's referring to, but he may be referring to things like the Green New Deal and things mm-hmm. that a lot of people find alarming. And then he may also be referring to some of the voices that have become the most prominent are people like AOC, who may not even really represent what most Democrats stand for, but have just become the loudest.
And isn't running for president.
Yeah, right. But, so I'm not sure if he means the 2020 candidates or if he means...
But all the more reason the Democrats need to let other candidates come out and speak so that one particular person isn't controlling the entire conversation. And the Green New Deal, there are many people that like it, and there are many people that have concerns about it, but it's just one part of the conversation, and I think it's a productive conversation.
But I think that the Democrats... I agree with the letter writer. I think that the Democrats are screwing it up. I just can't tell you why.
Well, they'll find a way eventually.
Right. I mean, if that's the case, I agree with you. I mean, will they find a way to screw it up? Sure, probably.
When you say the Democrats, who are you talking about? It is such a diverse, large, gigantic tent. Exactly where are you pointing the finger? I think that's difficult to do.
If Biden's your best candidate, say hypothetically that you think that he is, and
I don't, but go ahead.
And there's this internal firing squad that's doing them in with all this, hair sniffing stuff. I mean, is that screwing it up? In some people's opinion, that would be.
Well,
right?
It's unavoidable. It's if you want to run for office, the highest office in the land, you're going to be under a microscope, and your past is going to come back.
Mm-hmm. Your hair sniffing.
So Ken says, and Monson, we are not seeing a failure of leadership from the right wing. We are not seeing a failure of leadership from the right wing. They are utilizing chaos as a distraction technique to pilfer the country and the 99%. It is a strategy. In the midst of the anarchy, they are ripping us off at every turn. When the dust settles in 2020, they will have made off with trillions. Ken from Monson. All right, moving right along. I just can't do this. Okay. Jamie says, I wonder if and when the Whig Party fell apart, if they engaged in the same self-destructive behavior we find the GOP willing to engage in. I wonder if they too found their party so devoid of ideas that they latched onto some blunderbuss political figure who led them to their final demise. The lack of intellectual grounding of the GOP makes me believe if history is repeating itself, they would be totally oblivious to those events.
Wasn't that Teddy Roosevelt? Wasn't he the last presidential candidate the Whig Party had?
Not the Whigs. Teddy, not Teddy. We're talking about back in the day. Teddy was a Republican.
But I thought he ran on the Whig ticket.
Bull Moose. He ran on the Bull Moose ticket. Okay. It was a third-party ticket. And it was as good as it was going to happen, but couldn't. And it's the reason what Taft lost.
So who was the last Whig Party presidential candidate?
I don't know, but it was back way before Lincoln.
Okay.
You know? Okay, so Keith says, friends, Trump will continue to blather in front of the cameras all the while the administration will dismantle regulations to enrich his billionaire friends, ruining our air and water. Any economic improvement for the middle class will only be tokens to be held up as evidence of great economic policy. The Republicans will hang with Trump to continue the dismantling of the government because their agenda is being accomplished. They will look the other way until they can't. And that's from Keith. Well, that's what I was saying before. When you come to a point where you know you're going to lose your majority in the Senate because Trump is doing the wrong thing on health care, you protect yourself. In the end, you have to protect yourself. It's an instinct. You see a tiger coming at you? Put your hand in front of your throat. Anna says, yes, Joe is right. The birther insanity went on for years before the correspondence dinner, which was right before they got bin Laden. Obama was feeling good. Thanks, Anna. Michael says, Trump ACA. If Trump supports DOJ suing to take down ACA, doesn't he and all the Republican congressmen and senators get political cover if the judiciary can be blamed for taking down ACA? If so, then Trump's reversal about ACA keeps his train on the same track. Get rid of the ACA. And that's Michael.
A lot of alphabet soup there. Department of Justice, yeah. ACA is Affordable Care Act, AOC. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
But that's not going to happen, though. I mean, the Supreme Court has already ruled on the ACA.
This latest guy.
Most people think it's frivolous, though. Most people think there's just really no real legal argument to be made here. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's just going to go nowhere. It's another waste of time.
My good friend, most people thought Trump couldn't be the president of the United States. Don't you see?
No.
Vincent, most people aren't always right.
Well,
Vincent said health care. Good morning. The problem with healthcare is executive heavy medical and insurance vendors, the insurance overhead costs and profiteering. Price gouging is standard practice in the world of healthcare. Why should a popular depression medication be marked up 42,000%? Good point.
Good story this morning on diabetes care, this insulin on NPR.
Well, on NPR, and then I saw a very good story, as trade favors with you, on the front page of the Eagle, about various medications that were being opioid medications. And Renee says, Trump's mental health. Trump talked about the 2018 elections being rigged, encouraging his base to be paranoid about elections when Democrats win. This is very frightening as I see Trump inciting truly dangerous behavior from people who may be armed. I see Trump as psychiatrically unhinged and his party complicit in enabling a catastrophe. And that's from Renee. Well, Renee, yesterday I believe there were tweets about how the last election, congressional elections, were rigged themselves, which is why he's saying they were able to take over the House, the Democrats. That's all I have, Joe.
Okay. So let's
wait, there is something else.
All right.
Sorry about that. Charles says, Honduran immigrants, Alan, as a Peace Corps volunteer in Honduras 2002 to 2004, I got a deep lesson in the symptoms of poverty in that country. At that time, there were 12 million people, only 1 million jobs. In San Pedro Sula, there were 26 gang members to every police officer. It is a country cannot operate with civility under these conditions. For Trump to suggest cutting our aid in response to their immigration is to ignore the entire problem and blame the poor for their poverty.
Thanks for the insight, Charles.
Scott says, self-fulfilling and cruel policy. Trump cutting aid to Central American countries would aggravate their economic problems and cause more northward migration. This is in Trump's interest since it makes his dire warnings ever truer and more threatening to his base. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy and another cruel and cynical move by Trump. And that's from Scott. And then we heard from Tobias. I was interested to hear your discussion on the topic of does Trump dislike immigrants because they're not white? And this issue is completely ignored. I believe his racism is the sole reason. Trump operates like a fascist by turning his supporters against those he can make into evil others. And migrants of color are an easy target for him. And then Pierre says, good morning, panel. We are in a so-called crisis at the border because of our past interventions in Central America. The three countries from which the majority of these refugees come are the same ones in which we intervened over the past 60-odd years. And then Elias, or I think it's Elias, because he has a big A in the middle of his name. I reject the idea that both parties share equal blame for immigration problems. Obama offered several solutions to these issues, which were agreed on by the various border state Republicans. The right-wing element in the House stopped these programs using the Hastert rule.
All right. It is time for a break. We go over to news with Ray Graff and other stuff. We'll be back right after this. I was going to do this off the air, and then I decided to do it on the air just because I thought it'd be more fun. But we have we can talk about the Mar-a-Lago arrests, Trump on Puerto Rico, or the Mueller report subpoena. Which one would you like?
Mar-a-Lago.
Mar-a-Lago. Okay. Is that the – we're all on sure. board for Mar-a-Lago? Sure. Excellent. This is a really weird story. So a Chinese woman carrying a thumb drive with malware was arrested at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. While the president was in town, he was not on property. He was at a golf course, a Trump golf course, but he was at the Secret Service was there because he was in town. Secret Service agents arrested a Chinese woman after she bypassed layers of security and gained access to the reception area of President Trump's Florida resort this past weekend, saying they found she was carrying two passports and a thumb drive containing malicious software, according to court documents. The incident renews concerns about how secure the president and his advisors are during their frequent stays at his Mar-a-Lago club. Remember the picture of the guy holding the football?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Remember
yes,
that of the, yes, the yeah, nuclear right. codes? Yes. Of, yeah, right. That was concerning. So it stays open for its members and their guests when the president is there. Why yeah. lose the business?
$1 million initiation, by the way, to get in.
Really?
That's right. That's and, right. And obviously that went up after the inauguration. Presidents say the woman first approached a Mar-a-Lago security checkpoint on Saturday, shortly afternoon, and told security officials she was there to use the swimming pool. One problem, she didn't have a swimsuit. But she asked if she was asked if a member was her father. She said she did not give a definitive answer. And then the Secret Service became somewhat suspicious later, but had difficulty in communication because there was a language barrier issue. Mar-a-Lago believed her to be a relative of a member and allowed her access to the property. The president, again, was in South Florida that afternoon golfing nearby, but there is no indication that he saw or interacted with the woman. Once on the resort grounds, she was approached by a receptionist and asked why she was there. After being asked several times, finally responded that she was there for a United Nations Chinese American Association event later in the evening. The receptionist knew this event did not exist, but when the Secret Service agent followed up with additional questions, she said that she had arrived early for the event so she could familiarize herself with the property and take pictures.
Okay, so I have a question for all of you people who are
yes.
so much smarter than I am, and I mean what is the potential use of the thumb drive with the malware on it? What do? You're walking by a computer and go,
whoa. Well, there's all kinds of things. Any place that you can insert it that's connected to the internet, that's connected to a system, you have a chance of destroying what's there. So it could be a laptop, it could be a handheld device, it could be anything. It just depends on what it's connected to. My question is, how can you be running a secure facility when you actually have Secret Service agents asking the question, why are you here? Isn't it after you reach the point of why are you here, haven't you already sort of breached security and you already have a problem? Why? The whole idea is to not have people there that you don't.
But it's a public, kind of quasi-public resort too.
Well, it's White House South, really.
I know, but that's what it's bizarre to have White House South also be a resort that pretty much anybody could go into.
And that makes money for the president.
I mean, this is my understanding of this, and anyone can take issue with it, of course. But it seems as though that the Secret Service is doing as they are directed to do. I don't know that there was any lapse in the Secret Service here, that because, as you say, it's quasi, people with membership can come in, so they can come and go. Their job is to protect the president and not to impede the running of the resort.
Right. If she had been a guest of a member, she would have had every right to be there.
Mm-hmm. Which they thought she might be because of her last name.
Right. And I think it's just that's the issue with, the heart of security matters and making exceptions for this particular administration. Because I think any outsider knows that, they're going to test any opportunity they can to get an in somewhere, see how close they can get. You know, we have people who do that all the time over the years, like by jumping the White House gate or something like that. But, you know, this isn't Washington, and this is a different place. And, I think people are curious, and I think this is an example of someone being semi-successful and
yeah, I mean, we'll probably learn more about who she is and what she was trying to do, but.
But do you? I'm also concerned about sort of just the racial bias in the case. Was she only sort of alerted to authorities because she's Chinese? I mean, could there be non-Chinese people walking around that could also be threats to the security of our country? To me, it's very disturbing that this is allowed to happen in the first place. It is essentially White House South. Yeah. And so what we really should be doing is protecting the country's secrets and security, both at Mar-a-Lago and at the White House in the same way. And there really shouldn't be a difference between the two.
Should the president be raising money for himself? Mm-hmm. Because he is. I don't care whether you say the kids are running it. They're not. This is his money. Mm-hmm. And it is a direct conflict of interest.
Well, I think that's exactly what this brings up. I think in no other case in history have we had a place where our taxpayer, Secret Service agents have to work at a private resort, essentially. I think to Chris's point, too, there are some general security issues. Like, for example, if I go to a high security private company, I still have to submit a background check to go to General Dynamics or something before I get there. So you have a list of, if you rent a hotel, you usually have a list of everyone who's there. So the basic are you on this guest list? No, you're not. Well,
right.
You know,
I mean, if she had been able to infect the Mar-a-Lago computer system, presumably that wouldn't have had any impact on, the White House's computer records. But who knows? I mean, maybe there is a connection there somehow. Yeah. I mean, hopefully they're kept distinct. But
we live in a remote world now. We all know from our own individual lives that we can do our work from our cell phone, or we can go to the office and do the work. I have to assume that the government is set up, the federal government is not much different at this point in time, and that the President of the United States can probably do his work remotely from his phone and his laptop anywhere. And so wherever the president is, regardless of who the president is, that should be a secure location. And anybody that's in that space, the Secret Service should absolutely know who and why they are there.
By the way, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, and I think this the essential conflict.
I mean, the White House itself is a semi-public building too, so it's not like it's a completely unique problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, visitors walk through there all the time, but
yeah, but you have to go through a member of Congress to get in there. Literally. It's not like you just show up.
You don't just wander around.
You necessarily, though. Yeah, I know. You don't wander around. Right.
And they don't go to the residential quarter.
Apparently this woman didn't go to the part of the complex where Trump lives.
How do we know that?
We didn't know what her intentions were.
There are some things that you would raise eyebrows of the items that were, for cell phones, I think, were among the things. And so the, some of the technology, even beyond malware, I mean, you could have something that's infected by malware and not know it, too, from a very basic standpoint. But I think also just this issue that has been talked about in the past couple of years of cybersecurity in general and having people not know enough about, you know, when to detect a legitimate threat, when not to, what security measures need to be set up in place to, you know, protect a place like Mar-a-Lago or other things. And that's just something that this administration has not seemed to take great concern with or investment in, despite other you know, funds going into other defense systems.
Well, we heard from Sean, who said, a thumb drive. I'm pretty sure that almost every Chinese thumb drive you buy on eBay has malware on it. It could be innocuous. What do I know?
Well, I mean, the word was malicious malware, right? I mean, that right? In the complaint. Well, I know in the complaint, in the charges, that they use that word. So I don't know, and I don't know what that means.
Well, and says who? No, I'm idea. Like, do we know that Secret Service, are they experts in assessing? There's a lot of questions I have about this whole situation.
Yeah, and who knows what she was after? Was she after was she just hoping to crash the Mar-a-Lago computer system? I don't know what that would do exactly.
Crash the party.
Yeah.
Was she after their guest list, which I guess would be interesting information?
Did she want to take, who knows, was she undercover for something else? There's so many questions, you know?
Yeah. All right, so Democrats are divided over how speedily to subpoena the Mueller report. The Democrats in the House Judiciary Committee are split over how aggressive they should be in their quest to get the full report of Special Counsel Robert Mueller, along with any investigative materials that went into its preparation. On Wednesday, the panel will vote, that is today, probably along party lines, to authorize its chairman, Gerald Nadler, to subpoena the full report from Attorney General William Barr. Nadler is not expected to turn around and issue the subpoena to Barr straight away, giving the attorney general at least a few days to hustle the report to Capitol Hill before resorting to legal measures and a potential court battle in an attempt to force his hand. Meanwhile, many panel Democrats do not share Nadler's patience and want the chairman to serve Barr with a summons for the report right away.
They should definitely do it. There's no question, because what it does is it puts the—
They should do the summons?
They should do whatever. I mean, they should definitely do the subpoena. They should definitely do the summons, because in each case, what it does is it puts the Republicans on notice and puts more pressure on them that they are hiding something by not letting the report out. So therefore, I say move it, boys. And girls.
It's also their job. It's their responsibility. They were elected to a legislative body that has great oversight capacity, and to not— I actually think that any person that's been elected to office, regardless of party, at the federal level, that does not want to see the entire Mueller report, I think that they are failing in their responsibility to the people.
Well, you had a Congress that voted unanimously, basically.
We should see it. We should read it. Our elected representatives should see what actually happened and make judgments based on real facts.
What about things like the grand jury issue all of that? What do you think about that?
I think that—
So you're saying that none of it should be redacted?
I think, I'm negotiable on the redacted thing. I think, you know, there are things that involve national security that I think we do need to protect.
Well, but tell you, once you are open to that, then you're open to—
I don't know what these— I think that they should try to subpoena to get the entire document unredacted. They absolutely have the necessity and authority, and we're elected to do that. And I think every member of Congress should want to see it unredacted. Whether they'll get that or not, I don't know, but they should try. And I also think waiting— I don't see any point in waiting on this. What's the delay does nothing but, I think, make them look weak.
But they're doing it because they know that every day they wait, people will lose interest. That is their basic hypothesis.
You mean the—
No, but
Democrats.
Some Democrats think they should wait, too. I think that's what you were saying.
I don't see any point in the Democrats waiting, because I think it just weakens their position if they wait.
Well, the Democrats are waiting because they have a tremendous political tool here. In other words, going into the election, people are going to be ticked off that they can't see this report. It's one more thing. It's why a lot of Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi and others, did not want an impeachment move forward, because right now they're going to win both the House and the Senate.
I just want to clarify for my own slowness on this, but when you say some Democrats, so we're looking at Nadler, who's saying, all right, we'll do the subpoena, we'll vote for that, and then we'll wait to see how they respond before we do the summons to to get it in. Does everyone think that's a good idea, just to give them at least the time to respond?
I don't think he has much choice. I don't think he has a choice.
Because here. Democrats, other Democrats are saying, you know, scream and yell and get it today.
I don't think he has a scream and yell. I think they vote. I think you issue the subpoena as soon as you vote, and
then
the process begins.
They're going to do that.
I don't think you need to wait two or
three
or 4 days.
The White House is going to say, no, we're not going to comply. Right. They're going to drag their heels. The people who want, you know, who don't like Trump will be pushing like crazy. The people who like Trump will be saying, you know, just don't do anything, and he will do nothing. That's what he's going to do.
Yeah, it's whether they start the process today or next week, that's the way it's going to evolve.
But I think Alan's point is interesting, too, that, you know, the longer the political tool you have here, the longer you can prolong it, the better for the Democrats, right?
Well, but the Republicans think the same thing. That's what's so interesting here. They think the longer they can prolong it, the more people will lose
keeping people to seeing it. But I mean, as far as getting the information out.
But the longer the Democrats prolong it, the more it looks like a political game, because it shows that they're not really interested in getting the report. It's 400 pages. You need to get the report and start reading it, because theoretically it's going to take you quite some time to digest this. So waiting to do that just makes it look like you don't really care about reading it. I think they really need to be aggressive about this. They don't have to be out there pounding on the desk. They don't have to make a big deal about it. They just need to be on record of having done it.
All right. We just have a few moments left, and let us end with the Puerto Rico story. This is also quite a story. Again, the president is lashing out at Puerto Rico, bewildering the people on the island. This is all in relation to the disaster aid package. Mr. Trump's latest invective toward the local leaders of an island devastated by a hurricane in 2017 came in a torrent of tweets, which began on Monday night and spilled into Tuesday morning. Mr. Trump was reacting after the Senate on Monday blocked billions of dollars in disaster aid for Midwestern states, in part because Democrats said a proposed $600 million in nutritional assistance to Puerto Rico fell short of its needs. President Trump on Tuesday lashed out at Puerto Rico and the lawmakers as grossly incompetent, and singled out his favorite targets, the mayor of San Juan, as crazed and incompetent. Puerto Rico got far more money than Texas and Florida combined, yet their government can't do anything right. The place is a mess. Nothing works, Mr. Trump wrote on Twitter. He also stated incorrectly that Puerto Rico had received $91 billion in aid from the federal government. In fact, FEMA and other agencies have so far distributed $11.2 billion in aid.
One thing real quickly, the Puerto Rican population obviously comes into the other, quote, the other. The same people who are coming over the border, Spanish speaking, maybe their skin is a little darker, and that's what it is. It's the other, and he's just staying with his playbook.
Yeah, I was just going to say that this is an administration that has brought us the term alternative facts. They're always bringing in these alternative facts about everything. And now they've brought us alternative maps. As we all heard yesterday, we had a spokesperson for the Trump administration referring to Puerto Rico as another country. That was followed by comments, I think, the day before about Mexico being three different countries. So now we have alternative maps.
That was a Fox.
Well, I don't know. That article does go on to say that a lot of Puerto Ricans agree with Trump's assessment of the government and how ineffective and corrupt it is.
It's not good.
It is a problematic place.
But I think
you could argue how, you know, that this isn't particularly helpful. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to add on to that is the fact that Puerto Rico is an associate of the United States. So if you, again, want to see change of the country, then you have to positively influence it and say, like, okay, how is your plan going? You know, they have done a lot of refinancing, and they've got like 34 years or almost 40 years worth of high interest like loans right now as part of their rebuilding effort. You know, as far as the inequities between money distributed to Puerto Rico versus places like Texas and Florida, that's a FEMA problem too, as well. I think there is evidence and documents that, you know, those offices are still undersupported, that there's reason that even though there is a certain amount of aid earmarked, that it hasn't been getting to any of those places. I think that's part of the problem too. But again, because this there's just a lack of awareness or interest from this president in understanding why the issue is the way it is. You know, herein lies, you know, why it's easy for him to just lash out.
And this also ties into the history of Puerto Rico in itself, and that, you know, why hasn't it become a state in the union instead of a territory? And if it was a state, would we be having these types of issues? Would it be under the same type of democratic process as the rest of our states?
The same thing of representation. I mean, there are decisions that need to be made, you know, for this territory, yet they don't have representation in Washington where decisions are being made. So if you don't have a legitimate voice at the table, that's the problem, too.
We are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Terry Gibson, and Chris Churchill. We will see you all next week. Thank you very much. We'll be back with more show right after this.